It's that time of year when best of lists are being drawn up, and lovers of the English language come together to select the coolest word or phrase. Last year, we were talking about app, which was voted the word of the year by the American Dialect Society. Now, that group of etymologists, writers, historians, and other language experts is again calling for your nominations. Linguist Ben Zimmer is the chair of the new Words Committee and joined us to offer his picks for 2011. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ben, what is the top of your list?
Well, in terms of the word that I think is most likely to win, I would say it's occupy. That word has certainly been hard to avoid over the last few months, and it's really taken off in a surprising way. So that this word occupy, starting with Occupy Wall Street, has had a kind of a modular effect. You can occupy, fill in the blank, anything that you would like. There are even parodies of it, Occupy Sesame Street, Occupy My Couch, lots of different variations on the theme. And it's become so powerful that it has become a kind of a call to action in itself. It's an old word, of course, but it's been invested with lots of interesting new meanings.
And another political movement has given the lexicon another new term that looks like it'll stay for a while, and that's Arab Spring.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, when we look back on this year, 2011, Arab Spring may really be the phrase that we remember. It's modeled on past expressions like Prague Spring of 1968, or even going all the way back to the 18th century with the Springtime of Nations, with the revolutions in Europe. So this idea of spring being connected to popular uprisings, it has a long history to it, and that has become the label under which all of these activities in the different countries have been known and recognized. And so that is certainly, a powerful bit of language for the past year.
There were also some phrases coined this past year that poked fun at world leaders, and there was one world leader in particular who was very easy to make fun of.
I'm guessing you're talking about Italy's Silvio Berlusconi. He was done in by revelations of sex parties, and the label that was used for these sex parties was bunga bunga. And now that's quite an evocative and suggestive term, bunga bunga. It was a little mysterious exactly what might be referred to there. But as soon as bunga bunga got not just into the Italian press, but the English language press worldwide, people really picked up on that. And it was an easy way to make fun of Berlusconi's troubles as he was going down.
So what about pop culture?
Some of the diversions that we had this past year included Charlie Sheen at the beginning of the year having his rather bizarre public breakdown with his own special language that people picked up on. You may recall Winning, Tiger Blood, Adonis DNA, all of these Sheenisms that people started trading. Now, that has faded a bit. And one interesting thing, too, about Winning, as an example, is that one of its sources of its success, I think, was from Twitter. And this is true of Occupy and some other key terms from the past year. These single words can often get a special power on Twitter by being used as hashtags, where you use the hash sign followed by a word or phrase to identify what you're talking about. It could be a subject matter, it could be a little joke. But these hashtags actually end up having the power of slogans or mantras and really help to spread words and phrases in a popular way.
I know it must be hard to pick a favorite, Ben, but if you had a favorite, what would it be?
Well, a personal favorite of mine from the past year was humble brag. And that's a term that came up on Twitter, actually, in order to describe the kind of fake humility that we often see celebrities when they're tweeting and talking about how tough their lives are. They've got so many bathrooms in their mansion. And so the comedian Harris Whittles started up this term humble brag, which really nailed this particular type of pampered discourse on Twitter. And so it was a perfect little term to describe something new and funny that was happening this year.
Well, I'm sure listeners have many suggestions of their own, and you listeners can send your nominations for Word of the Year to WOTY@americandialect.org. Ben, it's been good talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Linguist Ben Zimmer is the new language columnist for the Boston Globe. Let's go now to a building in Greece where you could say the European debt crisis began and where it may reach its conclusion. Hannah Jaffe-Walt with our Planet Money team is our guide.
46 Piraeus Street does not have an exciting title or mission, really, for being the place where an enormous financial crisis began. It is the Greek Statistics Agency. What happened was that in October 2009, after an election in Greece, the new party came in and said, remember how we said the Greek deficit was around 6.7% of GDP? Yeah, it's actually twice that. Konstantinos Skordas works in the statistics office.
Everyone here in Greece said, what number is this? What happened?
So what did happen? I don't understand.
Nobody knows.
You guys work in the statistics office?
Yes.
Did you cook the numbers?
No. I believe no. But I don't know what the politicians did.
This number shocked the world, especially the world of investors. They panicked. And not just about Greece, but about Ireland and then Portugal, Spain, Italy. The crisis had begun. So last week, European leaders announced they had a plan to save the euro. There will be one strong central power to review and approve the budgets of all euro countries. And if that central power is not happy, it will send its own people in, technocrats, to fix things. That's the new plan. But in Greece, the technocrats have already arrived. The first place they went, 46 Piraeus Street.
My goal is to make this a competent, boring institution and not to be in the limelight. Actually, not to have to give an interview like this one.
Andreas Georgiou is the technocrat charged with saving the Greek statistics office. He is the kind of guy that opens a conversation by telling you he'd prefer you disappear. He's shy. He's Greek, but he's lived outside the country for the last 2 decades, working at the IMF. His first priority when he got to Athens was to get to the bottom of that 2009 deficit number. He looked through all the data and determined the final deficit number to be 15.8%, bigger than the deficit number that started the crisis and much higher than the one before that. Eurostat, the central authority in Brussels, praised Georgiou's methodology and blessed the number as true. Now, the hundreds of Greek people who work beneath Georgiou at the statistics office, the old guard like Skordas Kostadinos, did not.
Everybody said, oh, what number is this? We expected to discuss this matter.
Skordas sits on a governing board for the statistics office, and his board wanted to debate and vote on the deficit number before anyone in Brussels was allowed to see it. Georgiou, the technocrat, saw that as a threat to his independence. He refused. The number is the number, he said. You can't vote on it.
But then something happened, which was absolutely shocking.
Georgiou says his email was hacked by his staff, one of the Greek old guard. The accused denies this vigorously. There's a criminal investigation. Then there were strikes against Georgiou, the technocrat, statistics workers picketing outside the building. And then in October, Georgiou got an invitation from the Greek prosecutor for economic crimes.
To my surprise, they asked me where my lawyer was.
Turned out the prosecutor was investigating Georgiou himself for allegedly acting in cahoots with Eurostat and European authorities, deliberately trying to make Greece look bad by inflating the deficit number. If Georgiou is charged, he faces life in prison.
Potentially under something called breach of faith against the state.
So at this point, this process, sending in the technocrat to bring everyone in line, the idea which is at the center of the plan to rescue Europe, seems to be going very badly. When I ask Kostadinos Skordas, the Greek old guard, what exactly is the problem? Why can't you work together with the technocrat and the European Statistics Service? He says this.
Eurostat is not our boss. Its country is independent. We are not part of the Eurostat. We are a service of Greece. We are not service of Eurostat.
To me, there is no Greek statistics versus European statistics.
Again, Georgiou, the technocrat.
It's all European statistics, and we have to follow the European rules. There is not us and them. We're not sitting on opposite side of the table.
For the moment, they do appear to be sitting on opposite sides of the table. If what the euro needs is fiscal unity to really work, it'll mean getting people like Skordas to buy into Georgiou's vision. All Europeans, all on the same side of the table. The technocrat side. Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Our next story is about what happens after you click the place order button online, but before that holiday package arrives on your doorstep. The National Retail Federation estimates that 38% of holiday purchases will be made online this year. And if UPS, FedEx, and Postal Service trucks are the real-world equivalent of Santa's sleigh, then the real-world Santa's workshop would be something called a fulfillment center. NPR's Ted Robbins takes us to one.
The fulfillment center for Target.com is enormous.
It's about 16 football fields you can put in here end to end.
Winnie Wintergrass is general manager of this facility on Tucson's east side, one of five Target fulfillment centers. We walk inside yellow safety lines on the floor so we don't get hit by forklifts carrying goods or run into the 6 miles of conveyor belts and spiral chutes carrying products up and down three levels.
So this is where it all starts.
When a customer, Target calls them guests, places an order online, it goes to a machine where a barcoded shipping label prints out and...
with our automatic box builder, is actually building the box that the guest is going to actually receive.
Software figures out the geometry of all the items in an order and constructs the correct size box for shipping. That barcoded label on the outside makes sure the box travels to the next stop. Javier Polendo stands between a conveyor belt carrying the boxes and a long row of toys on shelves. He holds a handheld scanner on the box, and it tells him which shelf an item is on. In this case, it's a Play-Doh Autobot workshop. Think about it. In a store, you have the item in your hand when you buy it. With online shopping, if one of the 220 permanent or 100 seasonal employees at this fulfillment center picks the wrong item, it could mess up someone's holiday. So Javier Polendo pays close attention.
For me, it's just like you feel getting gratification of just being able to get all these orders out, and you know all these people are getting all these other products that they ordered online and stuff, so you kind of feel like Santa Claus.
Need gift wrapping? Then your box goes to, get this, the big wrap semi-automatic gift wrapping machine. Then the seemingly endless stream of blenders, microwaves, Barbie dollhouses, and Scrabble games head to waiting UPS trucks. Between Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday this year, this fulfillment center processed more than 300,000 orders. Fulfillment centers are either huge or they're small boutique operations like Custom Back Office Solutions, also in Tucson. The biggest week so far here, 2,000 orders. Even the head of the company, Jean Real, pitches in. She's putting stickers on a paint set for blind children.
It's been available online, and we just were waiting for these Braille stickers to come in. So I'm doing it just to get the orders that we have on back order out.
Custom Back Office Solutions is what's called a third-party fulfillment center. It charges companies to store inventory and to ship orders. When a customer places an order on a client's website, it ends up here. There's a nonstick cheese knife, jewelry supplies, herbal sprays, T-shirts. Jean Real says she likes helping small companies, businesses which need to focus on manufacturing, marketing, and sales, not picking, packing, and shipping.
Where's the best place for them to use their time? Is it putting things in boxes? That really isn't the best use of a business owner's time.
They use barcodes here, too. The rest is not so high-tech. The four full-time and two part-time employees here put the packing tape on manually. Big or small, though, holiday orders in the digital age are usually fulfilled, that is, out the door, in 24 hours. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Tucson.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Janet Ivanovich has just published Explosive 18. It's the 18th in a series of crime novels featuring Jersey girl Stephanie Plum. Plum's hair is big and her personality bigger. She's a bounty hunter in Trenton who works for her bail bondsman cousin, has a couple of love interests and a lot of laughs along the way. Janet Ivanovich has a lot to laugh about as well. She has sold more than 75 million novels. The books fuel the empire that is Team Ivanovich. Her daughter handles the website, her son the finances, and her husband is her agent. Janet Ivanovich has made it big, but she didn't start out writing crime novels.
You know, I started as a romance writer. I did 12 romance novels, and that was a pretty simple existence for me. But when I moved over into Stephanie Plum, And the first thing that happened to me, of course, was that I sold it to the movies, and I sold it for $1 million. Now, we were not wealthy people. My dad worked in a factory, and I was the first to go to college. And we had a lot of debt sending our kids through school. So all of a sudden, you know, our lives changed. And we said to our kids, we have all this money. We're going to pay off all your education loans. And you can choose what you would like to do, if you want to go to law school or if you want to join in with us and we'll, you know, do this book thing together. And they both chose to come on board. So it was, you know, kind of this gradual process.
Well, tell me, how did you create Stephanie Plum? Who or what was the inspiration for this character that so many people love now?
I know what I like as a reader. I know what I like to see on television and in the movies. And I thought I had a sense of who my audience was. So I knew what kind of a heroine I wanted. I knew that she would be likable. I knew that she would be a little vulnerable. She wouldn't be perfect, but she would try very hard. She would have some flexibility in her makeup. She would be a tenacious person. You know, some of the things that I really admire in people. And then, because I wanted this to go on for a long time, I gave her some of myself. I thought this is a way of keeping the character consistent, you know, of knowing the character. So Stephanie has some of me. I gave her a lot of my history. And then, of course, there's a lot of my daughter in Stephanie, because my daughter is Stephanie's generation. You know, I'm a generation away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this woman. I knew that I wanted to have some hot guys in her life because I loved that as a romance writer. I was never very good, you know, at all the detailed sex scenes. He did this and then that. But I loved the adventure of it. I loved the romantic chase.
Yeah. And so you have these two guys who are, you know, one is a cop, Morelli, and the other ranger is this sort of mystery guy. He wears all black. He works in security in some way. And I was wondering, she's in a triangle with these guys. Do you ever plan to make her decide once and for all which one she wants?
I love the triangle. And I love, I kind of like the indecision that she has, you know, because Stephanie's a pretty normal person and we all have our moments of indecision. And we all live a little vicariously through her with these, I mean, you know, how bad is that? And, you know, here's this woman who, you know, sometimes can't quite get the snap together on the top of her jeans. And she has a lot of bad hair days. And she's not fabulous at her job, but she sort of, you know, gets it done. She doesn't have a great car. And she has these two amazing men who just think, you know, she's the most attractive woman on earth. And, you know, so like, we should all have this problem, you know. I just think it's fun.
I want to give our readers who may not have read your books an idea of what Stephanie is like. And I was wondering if you could read a passage from the book, Explosive 18. This is a description of Stephanie getting ready for a funeral after a very rough day.
By 6:30, it was clear there was only so much improvement I could expect from ice. I got dressed in a black pencil skirt, black heels, a cream sweater with a low scoop neck and matching cardigan. I wore my hair down and fluffed out, hoping it would distract from my monster bruise and cut lip. I smeared on a lot of concealer, tried to balance out the black eye with extra blush, and I was wearing my push-up bra for maximum cleavage. I took one last look in the mirror and thought this was as good as it was going to get. I dropped my new Glock into my purse, along with the stun gun on steroids. I was wearing the GPS watch, pearl earrings, a Band-Aid where the knife had nicked my neck, and a huge Band-Aid on my skin knee. I was the all-American girl.
She's very funny. And it seems to me that humor really is what kind of is the main engine behind your books.
Yes, Stephanie doesn't take herself too seriously. And I think this is a good thing in today's world, because I think there are a lot of people out there who do take themselves way too seriously. And you know, we need a little humor in our lives to balance all that out. We don't appreciate the value of humor sometimes. You can get through very serious and sometimes horrible and sometimes embarrassing and very awkward situations with humor. It gives us a way out.
You know, we should say about the movie, although the first book was optioned, it's only now coming out as a movie, right?
Yes, January 27th.
Why did it take so long?
I don't know. I don't know. We have asked ourselves that at the dinner table every day for 18 years. I just don't know. But I'm glad it's finally happened.
Well, do you ever run out of ideas? I mean, do you ever get tired of the Stephanie Plum story? And
I wouldn't say that I run out of ideas. Sometimes I'm a lot more clever than other times. I consider myself to be a professional, you know, and I show up for work every day on time. Just as any professional would, a nurse, a doctor. We put our time in and we do our job and just hope that it works out well. And I have a lot to draw from. I created a very good situation for myself because there are all these auxiliary characters that I can pull forward. And that helps a lot for me. And, you know, I mean, there's just so much craziness out there in the world. It's like I couldn't fit them all in my books. I mean, I'm a real voyeur. I go to bars and restaurants and I sit and I eavesdrop on people. And I watch people in shopping centers and, you know, I read the newspapers and I talk to the Trenton cops. And I just get a lot of information that comes in and, you know, somehow turns into a book.
Well, Janet Ivanovich, it was really great talking with you.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Janet Ivanovich is the author of the Stephanie Plum novels. The latest is Explosive 18.
Listening to All Things Considered.
The Pentagon has developed new rules to ensure that service members are treated fairly when they use government money to attend college. The rules are set to go into effect next month, but many of the nation's best-known schools say they can't accept the new requirements. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the dispute puts at risk millions of dollars in federal assistance.
All year long, military advocates have warned that some schools see servicemen and women as walking dollar signs. Federal money for active duty students is particularly attractive to for-profit schools, which have been signing up members of the services in record numbers. At a hearing in September, Senator Jim Webb of Virginia said colleges need to provide more information so these students know what kind of school they're attending and whether they can succeed there.
Total cost of program, transferability of credits, default rates, graduation rates, job placement rates upon graduation are a few ways to ensure transparency.
The Defense Department says we've been listening and we're cracking down. Starting January 1st, schools will have to sign a special memorandum before they can receive what's known as tuition assistance for active military. Schools must charge military and civilian students the same tuition. They have to give students a clear education plan, and they have to try to give students academic credit for some of their military training. That last point raised eyebrows at places like the University of California, where Lawrence Pitts is provost.
UC has a very careful process for reviewing courses taken outside of UC.
Pitt says he cannot promise in advance that UC campuses will give credit for military training. His schools want to review training courses one by one. So like other prestigious public and private universities, UC says it will not sign that memorandum.
If we did that on a regular basis, we would have a number of students ill-prepared and not be able to take full advantage of university education at UC.
Many for-profit schools, however, have signed up. They say this shows they're more in tune with the needs of non-traditional students like those in the service. Brian Moran of the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities says his for-profit members are happy to recognize military training.
It's something that we feel is important to these service members, and we embrace a seamless transferability of credit in recognition of the experience of active service military as well.
The fact that military money might be headed to more for-profit schools is particularly annoying to people like Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. Harkin's committee has held hearings highlighting what he says are aggressive recruiting practices by for-profits, some targeting the more than $500 million annually in tuition assistance.
One has to ask, why is it that all the good schools are not signing the Memorandum of Understanding and all the bad actors are?
The Defense Department would not comment. Military service groups have been outraged at the idea that students could not use their tuition assistance dollars at hundreds of recognized colleges. They've written to Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, asking him to put these new rules on hold. They've been joined by 52 senators from both parties. Some colleges say if the issue isn't resolved, they'll try to find money elsewhere so members of the military can stay in school. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
All Things Considered continues in a moment.
The title doesn't have the number in it, but anyone who cares knows Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol is really Mission Impossible 4. The movie is opening this weekend on huge IMAX screens only. Next week, it will be in regular theaters. Film critic Kenneth Turan says, sit back and enjoy the ride.
The Mission Impossible movies change locations and directors each time out, but one thing remains constant. Tom Cruise's starring role as Ethan Hunt, the intrepid government agent who takes on the evildoers of the world.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it.
In Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, Hunt and his team bluff their way into the Kremlin to gather vital information about a brilliant madman who's stolen Russia's nuclear launch codes and will stop at nothing to destroy the world. But then things go horribly wrong.
An hour ago, a bomb blew up the Kremlin. The president has initiated Ghost Protocol. The entire IMF has been disavowed. Now I've been ordered to take you to Washington, where they will hang the Kremlin bombing on you and your team, unless you were to escape after assaulting Brandt and me.
If characters in other movies eat danger for breakfast, Hunt eats it for lunch and dinner as well. Orchestrating his exploits is director Brad Bird, making his live-action debut after three exceptional animated films, Ratatouille, The Incredibles, and Iron Giant. Bird brings visual flair and a playful touch to a film that is essentially a series of elaborate action set pieces. All that action benefits from Cruise's willingness to do his own stunt work, especially when the plot shifts to the city of Dubai and the Burj Khalifa, a glass wall tower that is considered the world's tallest building. Naturally, the plot calls for Hunt to climb up the outside, but it's Cruise, not a stuntman, we see in action in the neighborhood of the 130th floor. This is high anxiety with a vengeance.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.